As usual, I start off with the word okay. And this is Bob and Cameron again. And this is session number 15. And we're looking at my book through my tiny note chart. And we've done a few weeks on that. And Cameron has something to say about that, where we've gotten. So take it away.
Well, one thing that interests me is a comment that you made on our way to the recording this morning. And you said a couple times that your tiny note chart predicted certain things.
Yes.
And I'm wondering if the power to predict is what we're looking for in something like the tiny note chart. Is that what you see its function and value as being?
I was making a statement about the changes that the new technology Carolyn was working with in New York in 93 to 97, and it treated AIDS successfully. So what happens to the world when you have something that works and you even have a study confirming that, and you've got big names behind it, but then one guy dies, and the other guy was the nephew of the Shah of Iran, and he helped us, but nobody else cared. So in the tension of that situation about how long does Carolyn keep trying to plug away and get this going, so in 94, Governor Mario Cuomo changed the laws so that there was more opening opportunities for alternative medicine, which this technology would be put under that category. So she got to do it for 3 years and had a clinic and was very successful. But then the sneaky AMA, New York branch, came to us and said, you know, we're not in total control. We got to acknowledge this law, but we're telling you, do not ship this out of the state. So spreading it around across America and the world got stopped. So that frustrated the operation, and the widow of the inventor, who the inventor had died in August 93. So in the midst of all that, I was taking it seriously, what the technology Carolyn was working with, and I came up with this chart to show society's technologies were based on friction. So they were entropic. They had entropy. But the new technologies, represented by this thing that Carolyn had, and the inventor was Walter Fishman, to give his due, were into the new era of frictionless technologies. And Pons and Fleischmann's cold fusion was also being touted at that point. So with this idea of moving into the frictionless, I called that the hexadic, because the chart was five levels up to the pentad. Pentadic was the Android meme, sort of like the final extension of early technologies. And we moved into a new dimension. So I wrote at the bottom, waiting for organic bodies, the spinning clothing crystals have danced the hexadvertisement. I took hexad after pentad and put in brackets advertisement. So this was an ad for what was coming. So I was predicting what was coming, but it already had arrived. It wasn't a world environment yet. So that didn't get very far by the year 2000. So then Carolyn discovered the miracle of magnesium, wrote a book on it, and then got her on TV for 3 years, and that led into a whole other direction. And then Ion showed up in 2009, 14 years after the chart, and then Ion gave us abilities to make better technologies than the mirror. So that, in retrospect, is what I accidentally predicted. And
right, but notice how what you're saying is that at the basis of the tiny note chart is a technology and a physical technology, and the value that you see in the tiny note chart, and it could have been a conscious value at the time of construction, is that you mirrored this technology, and consciously or unconsciously predicted further developments in that line.
Yes.
So, I mean, okay, so that's interesting, but it's certainly not the only thing that thinking does.
Right, and I did create a mirror of the Internet, which I called the after image of the Android meme being from 1960 to 1990. So I can't remember how much I thought it was the Internet as I was making it. I just thought, okay, the valuable people to prepare for what's coming were LaRouche, McLuhan, Thompson, Croker, and myself, our thinking. So I was celebrating what we had done, but we were moving into something new that none of us foresaw, or I don't know how close we came to it in our work. But they were closer than anybody else, I felt. So it was a recapitulation of the memes or the thinkings and the environments that led to this new breakthrough environment. So I did have that in mind. And as I got more familiar with the Internet, I decided that this was a mirror of the Internet. But I don't know how much I consciously thought of that at the time. I was trying to acknowledge an arrival at some state of technology. That's why I came up with the term homeopathic, and I was featuring the ideas of McLuhan, LaRouche, Thompson, Croker, all mixed in my stuff. So they all contributed. And that's about what all I could say. But what was interesting is people didn't have they really said, what the hell is this? So once I laid out, like I did with you, how each section quadrant has characteristics that are repeated in the next quadrant, and it's all lined up pretty easily, once you know and notice that, then it became easy to be at least read. But nobody knew what it meant. But through the years, people still talk about it and still think they're understanding it more. So, you know, it wasn't useless. It still communicates to people. And then I got some other charts from ION, what we call the Angel Diagram, and we made a video. It cost us $58,000. I don't know if you've ever seen that. I should send that to you.
Yeah.
Have you seen it?
The Angel? No.
Okay.
Send it to me.
Yeah, that has ION explaining that chart. And then there was another chart, and I sort of realized the Android meme chart or Tiny Node chart complemented the Angel Diagram chart. ION started talking about the chart. I had not prompted it, and it has a lot to say about the chart and says it's actually referred to in the Bible, in the book of Revelation. So,
but just hold on for a sec. You mentioned several different charts. Are you back to talking about the Tiny Node chart, or are you talking about another chart?
Well, there's the Angel Diagram chart, and there's the another chart, I don't have a name for it, that ION unveiled.
So these are 15 or more years in the future, right?
Yeah, ION revealed the Angel Diagram 16 years later, 2000. And,
yeah.
Well, 15.
So that's quite a jump from where we are. But didn't ION say that there was some sort of malevolent presence of the angels in your chart that had screwed it up or screwed up your mind? I don't know anything about that.
Yeah,
but
no.
I think
no.
It would be interesting if you were to talk about that.
Yes, no. When I first talked and told us what it wanted to tell us, it was pretty avant-garde, but within known human ideas. But then they started pointing out that the angels objected to man, humans, being on the right-hand side of God. And so there was a battle between the angels. That was battle one in heaven. Then there was a second battle between the angels and men. So we learned more and more that the angels actually don't like humans and are going to do their damnedest to make sure we don't get to replace them on the right-hand side of God. And these terms are metaphysical. I'm not talking like a fundamentalist here, but these are terms that Ion used. But we found out from Ion deeper meanings of it. So most people think angels are there to help them or are friends and all that. They aren't. But once you get a certain level of power, spiritual power, you can control them. And then they have to do your bidding. So the angels influence the making of this chart for I don't know what reason. It hasn't been spelled out, but they helped me do it, and I wasn't aware of that. But I find out about it 15 years, 16 years later, and then a whole drama is unfolded between the meaning of the Taino chart from Ion's point of view and angels. So that drama has been going on for 10 years. And there's lots of stories I could go into that Ion explains, but no proof. He's got Ion's word for it, but Ion's a pretty unique source of information. And is psychic and predicts things and gets into people's lives and tells them stuff, and they like it, they learn. So it's all pretty great new university, I regard it as. So, and we've recorded over 31,000 hours with Ion. But Ion is, through the years, at first, the first 6 months, 2009 and in 2010, Ion would not let me talk about McLuhan, Croker, or anybody. He would shut me down. He says, no, Bob, we don't want to hear about that. We're going to tell you what we have to tell you. So after a year or so of telling me what they had to tell me, then they said one day, your five bodies are useful, and you have them embedded in the chart. So we're going to talk more about the chart, and which is actually mentioned in the Bible. And if McLuhan ever comes up, if you quote McLuhan and insist on it, you can quote McLuhan, but then you have to say, however, Bob says, and so I had to qualify McLuhan's take on things with whatever I was learning from Ion. So it was a funny drama. But over the last 10 years, Ion has become very expert on talking about Croker. He knows the books, so he can go into them, and Thompson and LaRouche. And he sometimes makes very interesting, he says, well, Croker will do this to you, but LaRouche does that to you. And McLuhan was over there doing this, and Thompson's back there screwing all three of them up. So he does go into their information seriously, but other times it's heavily joked. So we have a phenomenon in 2021 where this interesting voice is talking, using my ideas and talking about the four and five quadrants. Very funny. There's no other non-physical source talking about my chart, as far as we know. So it's become very involved with Ion, which I like. I'm glad that my chart's talked about. So that forced our listeners to look at the chart. And I have many, many hours explaining the chart. You know, we did a little briefing.
But is this taking the chart as gospel, or is this, at least in part, criticizing it? I mean, I don't see how the angelic presence in the chart can be good if it turns out that
right.
The angels are fighting you.
I know. It gets very complicated. And it's like talking, I thought of Finnegan's Wake when doing the chart. It's like talking about Finnegan's Wake. You can't figure, you know, what the hell are we dealing with here? No conclusions. There's no conclusions with Ion. Just figure ground statements and different grounds. So it's an ongoing drama of cognition, like life. So all these questions are legitimate. They come up. People who are listening ask these questions. But Ion's always got new answers. But there's hundreds of hours of commentary on it through the years, so I can't summarize it. But the proof is in the pudding. We have our technologies. We're going to present them to the world when the world cries out for them, which they're beginning to do. Our technology would be very helpful down in Texas now, but Texas is going to suffer a bit more and realize they ain't going to fix themselves, and then they're going to come to us. And that's why the Department of Homeland Security interviews us regularly about what are we going to do with this new power. You know, we bring in a new environment, we have some kind of immense power, right? And the present-day powers, they don't like that. So there's an ongoing drama with that situation. And then Carolyn's doing the same thing in medicine. So we have arrived at the situation, and Ian explains what we've done over the 10 years beyond what Carol and I understand. And we implemented this COVID-19 situation to lock down the world, which is predicted on the chart, lockdown Bob Rule. Turned out to happen. So I don't expect you to understand what I'm saying, but I'm just telling you the kind of stuff we talk about on the show. Now, is it gospel? I don't. Well, it's seems to predict some things, but maybe that's based on my and Ion and Carolyn's thinking. But I don't. It's like a new periodic table. I know we're making a new periodic table of elements, which you would be interested in, with our new materials, were substances we're making. And there's lots, if you took time, if you called in and just asked, Ion, could you review how you're changing the periodic table of elements? And Ion probably would lay it out for you. So you get an inkling. You wouldn't understand it all. But your talk about the elements, McLuhan, Medicology, and the elements with the chemistry level, and then my weather level, is very timely that you've come up with, because we're affecting the weather. So there's so much more that I would go into talking about it with you. If you came in and talked to Ion, we would then talk on the radio about it. Mm-hmm. But I'm keeping it for the uninformed, you know, trying to keep it simple,
right,
the way I did it originally.
To me, all of the stuff you're talking about lies on the other side of your book.
Yes.
Right? My interest is in trying to go more or less step by step. I don't like the linearity of that.
Right.
my notion is that by looking at your charts, by looking at the tiny note chart, we get an idea of where you're coming from in the book. Obviously, there's quite a gap between the tiny note chart in 1995 or thereabouts and the book in 2020 or thereabouts. So that's a quarter of a century, right?
Yes.
That jumps. However, the about two-thirds of the book leans quite heavily on McLuhan.
Yep.
And so I think I have a fair grasp of what was going on with McLuhan. And through looking at your charts and your tiny note chart, I'm getting an idea of what you're doing. And so the way I see us trying to proceed from here is to go from the end of your tiny note chart and to combine that with some talk about McLuhan, and with that to get into the detail of your book and to go through your book as it is before us.
Right. You know, and the other day, I don't know if I say at the beginning, I'm going to present unknown parts of McLuhan. But I thought better yesterday to say unused. A lot of my quotes, and you've read through them, are right there to be read over the last 50 years, but they're not used by anybody. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Other than you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, yes, right. I'm bringing out unused parts of McLuhan in the new
book.
Yeah,
so, I mean, to my way of thinking, all parts of McLuhan are unused because when scholars or researchers or whatever they are talk about McLuhan, they invariably place their citations and their thoughts into the Gutenberg galaxy, and thereby they essentially or fundamentally distort what McLuhan was saying. So from that perspective, all of McLuhan is unused.
Correct. Now, I'm sure if any of those people, Paul Levinson, Bob Logan, de Kerckhoff, if they listen to us, they'd protest. No, I know what McLuhan is and this and that. And you're probably not that interested in debating it, but you spend a lot of your time writing and correcting these people. And we'd have to get them to read what you wrote to see if they take it seriously or not. I mean, I take it seriously,
right.
And I agree with you, but I don't call up Paul Levinson and say, you know what, you're a disgusting McLuhan scholar, you know, and you haven't done anything. You know, what's the point in doing that? I might say it on my Facebook page in passing. Like, did you know that they did this 12-hour review of McLuhan on his birthday on July 21st, 2020? Did you hear about that?
I know that they did it, but I didn't listen to it.
Right, and I listened to all of it, and it was very frustrating and very timid and ridiculous. And they also had done a whole bunch of 11 weeks of talking to different groups of McLuhan scholars around the world. That was pretty tame. And that inspired me to write something. I said, look, the people ain't getting it. They're not going to know what McLuhan said. So in that sense, I insulted them all, but I didn't make a big deal about it. I just said, this needs to be updated from what they're saying, you know? And then you've already been doing that. So then out of the blue, you called me and said, hey, why don't we, let's resume our discussions after 5 years. And so I found that really important what we're doing, because I was delighted that what you said, and were interested in my book. So we're doing fine. And I think this is an important conversation for any McLuhanites that are around or are being born.
Right. And not only because we're regurgitating stuff that we already know about McLuhan, but in the dialogue, new stuff is emerging. And that's, to me, that's the most valuable part of what we're up to here.
Yes. I would like to hear de Kerckhoff and other people's responses. If they seriously listen to it, would they say, well, no, I said that or something? You know, I'd like to hear a serious response to what we're saying. And I'm willing to hear criticism about it or what I'm missing on what I don't appreciate and what they did. You know?
Yeah.
So it hasn't come forth yet.
Right.
But the non-professional McLuhanites are loving this thing. They find that we explain things very calmly and quietly, and they really like it.
Oh, good, good.
Yeah.
I hope they also think that it's an interesting sort of take on your stuff.
Yes.
Not on your final stuff by any means, but I kind of regard this as me interviewing you, and you get to recast your thinking in various ways that may make it more accessible or more interesting or more this or that for people that are interested in your stuff.
Oh, it definitely does that. And it's funny, you're interviewing me, but you're doing way more talking than me.
No, Bob, you're dreaming. You're talking 60 or 70% of the time.
No. Well, you're doing a lot of talking. You have to admit that.
Well,
let's say 50-50 then.
Well, if you want, but it's not true. let me bring up something that you said several times and that I think we should get clear about. You have used the term Esperanto to describe a kind of analysis that you think McLuhan was trying to get at. And when you've done that, I believe every time I've protested and I've tried to say that McLuhan, at least in my view, was not looking for an Esperanto. And a couple days ago, I thought, well, why don't I see what McLuhan said about Esperanto? And I could only find a single mention of it in his very first piece in Explorations. And what he says is the following. He says, the language of visual form is one which lies to hand as an unused Esperanto at everybody's command.
There it is. That's what I mean.
Okay, let's analyze this a little bit. When he says that it lies to hand as an unused Esperanto at everybody's command, and he compares it to visual form, what he's talking about is the fact that if you have a photograph of something, or if you have a comic strip that has no background required to understand it, then you're talking about visual form more or less like a light bulb.
And yes.
The comparison with a light bulb is that you don't need to bring anything with you in order to understand this.
Yeah.
Right? The visual form in McLuhan's, this is in the sort of early to middle 50s, he was using visual form in a way that needed to be rethought through acoustic space, but he hadn't found acoustic space yet.
Yes.
So he was using visual form as an Esperanto, but it was like a language without walls. Right?
Yes.
A picture is a world without walls.
Yeah.
So the problem that I see in confusing that with McLuhan's analysis is that light and photography and visual form in general, like comics, these are things which needed to be explained, not things that you could use to explain with, right?
Yes,
exactly. He needed to explain media plural.
Yeah.
Which meant that even things which seemed to be without a frame had a grammar, had a particular grammar that could be exposed. And so in Understanding Media, he explains the framework to the unframed, right?
Yes.
What does it mean in history that we have come up with media that no longer require sort of a national language or a national situation, that are inherently international?
Yes.
So I say that although Esperanto was a very interesting phenomenon to McLuhan, it isn't something that can be put forward as what he was trying to get at.
No, it's a metaphor. It's a literate Gutenberg mistake, but was usurped by the new invisible environment, which he recognized. Well, there's a kind of uniformity, or people who get on the same, not page, but it was very interesting. He said photography evoked the postures of the mind, which led to Freud and Jung. That's the most interesting statement McLuhan says about photography. And so those postures were communicated to people all over the world in pictures and newspapers and that, right? They were looking at the human form regardless of what culture it was or particular differences in the cultures. And he sort of stressed the psychic gestures that were coming out of the
people. This is exactly the time that he gets into the drama of cognition.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm trying to say, that even the unframed has a drama of cognition behind it.
Yep.
What you were just calling perception.
Yes.
Right?
Yep.
And at just this same time, 1949, 1950, is when he read Cosmic Man, or American Cosmic Man.
Yes.
Is the real title, by Wyndham Lewis. And Wyndham Lewis was getting into this problem of the unframed. You could call America the unframed.
Yeah.
As compared to every other country that has ever been.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
And McLuhan was greatly taken by Lewis's analysis, but as he says in a letter to Pound, here's this great book, and it had no effect whatsoever.
Yeah, fog.
I think he says something like a H-bomb set off in the desert or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, and he says fog, F-U-G. The result, fog. I think it's in that letter.
Oh, fog all. Fog all.
Yeah. And, you know, yeah. Norman Mailer wrote The Naked and the Dead or whatever around 1948 about World War II, I think. And he used F-U-G instead of fuck. He couldn't use F-U-C-K, but he used fug.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking McLuhan was aware of that, and that's what he did.
Definitely. Because I believe he uses the phrase fug all.
Yes.
Right? So that would make it obvious that that's what he was doing.
Right. Yeah. Now, so what were you? What was the sentence just before that? You were just quoting. What did he say? Again,
on Esperanto?
No, on what you just, the fug. What is the words before that?
Oh, I don't have that in front of me. I can find it.
But he was just saying there was no response. Yeah, he just said it was a bomb in the desert.
Said, yeah, it's a bomb set off in the desert, and it sets a kind of goal for McLuhan, right? A goal of thought. What would it be to come up with a kind of analysis that would have effect.
Right.
Right? And
yep.
At the end of the decade, he says that that's a criterion for a medium. Right? So in his discussions with the NAEB, he's always saying that what we're trying to achieve is what the sciences have already achieved, and that is that the teaching in a school is not essentially different from what goes on outside the school, right? And that's with chemistry as an example, what is going on outside the school is inherently chemistry. Everything is chemistry out there, number one. But number two, businesses are developing chemistry in their manufacturing techniques and their distribution techniques and their communication techniques, on and on. So chemistry is kind of redoubled externally. So what McLuhan says is, look, if we want to have effective teaching, if we want to have real education, right, to lead out, is the etymology of education, right?
Mm-hmm.
If we want to lead people out into the world as it is through education, then we need to have something that is the same between what goes on in the school and what goes on out there, right? And what goes on out there is redoubled. There's everybody talking, everybody doing whatever they're doing, and then there's theories about that. Now, it just happens that nobody knows what's going on when people are just talking, and the theories are all screwed up, right?
Yes.
So what McLuhan's task, you might say, is taken from the lack of practical effectiveness of Lewis's book, and he tries to turn that both into a criterion for what he's trying to do, and as a lead to what he's trying to do.
Yeah, let me say this. He says in 43, 44, when he is with Lewis in St. Louis in the States, he at some point says, I will dedicate a lot of my next few years to spreading the word that I got from you, from Lewis. And what's interesting, he picked the right guy because he didn't know it was coming, but Lewis comes up with that book 5 years later, 1948, and it does give McClellan, holy, this is new, important stuff. I got new stuff to say about Lewis rather than what he had said in the 20s and 30s. Then there's
right,
that.
Absolutely.
Yeah, then there's that in the Electric Light. They have the lecture he gave in 59 to what seems to be a small group in at St. Michael's, the Bazillions, where at the end he talks about Lewis's fate or mistake. He said Lewis failed to harness Protestant fury in his day. He was too amoral or non-judgmental on the kind of things that Protestants would get upset about. And then McLuhan says, he implies, I'm going to redo Lewis, and I might get response because we're now in a cool world where Protestant fury actually isn't as effective. So the relaxed state of Lewis's not being morally outraged, McLuhan will be that. He'll adopt the non-morally outraged stance, and it'll appear charismatic or unique. Do you remember that? He spells out what Lewis couldn't get going, interest in his work, and McLuhan figured out, well, I'll use the non-Protestant fury now because it'll work. The Protestant fury doesn't work in the TV age, and maybe the Protestants realized that or got frustrated. Do you remember mm-hmm. that statement?
Yeah, vaguely, vaguely, and it's I take that to be closely related to what we were talking about a few minutes ago, and that is that the non-judgmental, cool approach is necessary to science. As soon as science gets worked up about anything, it's going to be wrong.
Yeah,
right, because science is impersonal,
yep.
in Richard sense. Right? So McLuhan's whole approach to where they had to go, something he sort of figured out in the 1950s, consciously reached back to what he had learned at Cambridge and what he learned from Lewis at the end of the 1940s, what he learned by reading Pound's prose, and all the while kind of mixing all of this stuff up, shuffling the cards in a way that is somewhat similar to what you're doing in the
yeah.
charts, in the
yes.
Tony Note chart. He comes up with this idea that if we're going to have something that's the same in the school and out of the school, then it cannot be emotionally charged. It has to be not only neutral in the sense of analyzing everything, it also has to have a certain remove, right? And that
yep.
that remove is something that he had begun to remark already in the 1940s. How it was necessary to, in the maelstrom, it's necessary for the mariner to assess his situation in a way that his brother can't.
Yep.
And his whole saving gesture is to take a certain remove and in that way to be able to assess everything that was going around the flotsam and the jetsam. About him.
Right. Now, in the 60s, I don't think he said it in the 50s, he said that Louis Armstrong and jazz in the 20s created a global language. So then later, the subculture yeah. of literacy, you know, it had been subsumed by the Marconi galaxy, tried to reintegrate the American black into its values, but it was too
right.
late.
Right.
But it's a great ironic statement, and so he realized later there was an ear acoustic Esperanto, created by Louis Armstrong and the jazz world of the 20s. So that's something he didn't know, or he didn't say when he talked about visual form in 1953. So
I think that's true, but it's what you're talking about, this Esperanto as visual form, it actually applies to what you're saying about Louis Armstrong.
Well, that's what I mean. He came up with a more modern Esperanto than the visual form one.
Right, but behind the visual form and then whatever it was that was going on with Louis Armstrong, these are both presentations that are international.
Yes.
Right? They don't require rootedness. And so they force awareness of multimedia through the fact that they are inherently fluid.
Right? Yes.
As soon as one takes jazz seriously or takes visual form seriously, they lead beyond themselves.
Yep.
Right? So
yes.
That's why something like understanding media becomes possible. It's not possible when people are rooted in some sort of nationality,
yep,
and some sort of emotional commitment to identity. They cannot have an understanding of media because they really can't understand other folks' media.
Yep.
All they can do is look at other folks through their own. But with an internationalization of art forms through photography or through jazz or through rock and roll, it becomes not only possible, it becomes necessary to exist in multimedia.
Yep. So Lewis started too with that. McLuhan, I don't know, quote, went further or was it consolidated?
Deeper.
The vision.
Yeah,
deeper and consolidated. And he used to say that advertising was the organizing language for industry, for advanced countries, right? Advertising was the bond, the Esperanto within North American culture. It taught people what the value of these new technologies and environments were, what the satisfactions were. So that's the classroom,
right,
without walls.
Yeah, but that's true what you just said, but built into what you just said is an awareness of the limitation, right? The Esperanto of advertising, the Esperanto that teaches people what their satisfaction should be, is not the Esperanto of an analysis that can look at all of this stuff,
right,
and say what's really going on.
Right.
Right. So that's one more example of the use of Esperanto as it's helpful, but it's also limited.
Yes.
It's inherently limited.
Yep.
I've been rereading American Cosmic Man.
Okay, before you go into that, how did you find that quote? Do you have a lot of this digitally?
Yes.
You can just type in the word and find it immediately.
Well, if I'm in that program, when I'm talking to you, I try not to do that because I have the impression that I wouldn't be able to pay proper attention to our dialogue,
yeah,
if at the same time I was farting around in the,
yes,
in the database.
Right, but you have a database. Okay, so you just decided to reread American Cosmic Man lately.
Yes, and here's a very interesting quotation, I think it is. He says, this is Lewis, until you know something of the medium, and then brackets the political and social atmosphere in which these great figures live and have their being, it would be useless to attempt to delineate them for you. And what this is an introduction to when he's going to go into talking about American presidents, Roosevelt and, well, both Roosevelts and Wilson. But to me, what's interesting is here's McLuhan around 1949, 1950. He's reading this book, and here's a specific use of the word medium,
right,
and then brackets the political and social atmosphere, and a light goes off in McLuhan's head, and it directs him back to 1932. So at least 15 years in the past.
Yes.
And in 1932, he's reading Science and Modern Man. No, what's it called? Science and the Modern World, sorry, by Whitehead. And in Whitehead, there are literally hundreds, if not thousands, of terms that are similar to Lewis's The Political and Social Atmosphere.
Mm.
Whitehead talks about ages. He talks about mentalities. He talks about perceptions. He talks about just on and on and on of classifications, but the classifications are never thought about. They're just used.
Yeah.
And so here's McLuhan, he reads Lewis, and Lewis says the medium bracket, the political and social atmosphere. Well, number one, it's not clear that that's what a medium is. And even if that's what a medium is, it's not clear what a political and social atmosphere is.
Yes.
Right? So McLuhan, in my view, is reading this stuff, but he's reading it as a kind of pointer to what's wrong in what Lewis is saying, or at least what is unsaid and needs saying,
yeah,
and taking that as a pointer where he needs to go.
Yeah, now that's a really important discovery, because everybody talks about Global Village is evoked in that book, but nobody says, wow, here's Lewis beginning to point to the use of the word medium that McLuhan will develop. Yeah, that's really a great discovery. What page is that on?
I should be able to. Oh, I don't have, you know, I have different thumb drives, and it's on a different thumb drive. So I can't tell you that, but I can tell you that it's around page 35.
Okay.
If you want me to, I'll switch
drives away. No, that's all right. You just give me a general area.
I have one thumb drive with your book and your tiny note chart and stuff like that on it. And then another one has Lewis related. excuse me. I will definitely tell you, I know what I can do. I can go to American Cosmic Man is available on the Internet Archive.
Archive.org?
Archive.org. Yeah. And so I've just gone there, and I've already found what we're looking for. It's on page 34.
Great. It's interesting how the idea of the medium that McLuhan would make famous is there in different thinkers in the first half of the 20th century. They're yes. being forced. Nobody can miss it. If you're reasonably perceptive, you're going to start thinking that way. Because technology,
right,
the radio environment.
There's a certain inevitability to
it. Beg your pardon?
There is a certain inevitability to it.
Yeah.
Right? And to my way of thinking, it's especially apparent where the word itself may not be used, right? But where
Whitehead.
The concept, yeah, like. In Whitehead, the concept is indicated, but never thought through.
Yeah,
and so Whitehead may have actually used the word medium, and I believe he did. But and so did Lewis in the 1920s. But what happens with McLuhan is when he's saying to himself, "Okay, Lewis did this great stuff; it had no effect." how am I going to have effect? Then he takes the unthought as the way to tackle the problem.
The unthought?
Yeah. Now, the fact that medium was either explicit or implicit in what was going on, but it was never thought about.
Okay.
It was
worked out.
Right? And so it was, you could say it was being used, but not consciously.
Yeah.
And so McLuhan in the 1950s is trying to figure out how can I use a medium in a way that is thought, that is useful in indicating the drama of cognition.
Yeah. So did Innes help him there?
Definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Because what Innes was especially important to McLuhan was in indicating the importance of effects.
Yep.
So somebody like Whitehead or even Lewis, when they're talking explicitly or implicitly about media, they're generally talking about forms of thought. And what Innes does when he's talking about media is he thinks about what did they cause? How did they change social behavior? How did they change what men and women came to value? That's an important thing that McLuhan needed to be urged into.
Yeah. The what a heady time it was for him when he met Pound in 48. He's meeting Innes and then Carpenter, 48 to 52. Wow, what
sure.
An amazing turmoil he must have gone through.
Yeah, met Gideon
yes.
And Lewis both in 1943. He often said that his Cambridge experience was not as rich as it should have been in terms of getting to know Richards or Leavis, people like that, more personally, because he was going through so many changes that he was unable to sort of reach out as a integrated personality and get to know these folks. But by the 1940s, he was ready.
Yeah.
And so he met a series of really important people, and he came to believe that the ability to meet people was a very important part of advanced education.
Yeah.
And not many people can do that.
Meaning go in and meet people and engage them, get their attention?
What I mean is to be in the presence of greatness without being too intimidated or too overbearing. To be in the presence of a great person requires, above all, an ability to listen and to respond to them in a way that makes them know that you are listening.
Yeah, yeah. Yep, and what was I going to say? So he said he was very lucky in who he met. And he says to Mike Wallace around 1966, he says, what are you investigating? What are you doing? And McLuhan says, I'm investigating you. and he also says in the hot and cool interview, you have to have a superiority, a kind of arrogance to deal with the environment. So he had a natural superiority complex anyways. And so he could meet with superior people. Or, giants of achievement, intellectual achievement, because he already had a kind of self-confidence in himself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I think the superiority with McLuhan is, above all, a certain distance. It's not a kind of vertical looking down.
Right.
It's a distance that allows a kind of etiquette a kind of politeness that is difficult for many people, right? It's really the prerequisite for dialogue.
Yep, the poise.
You need, poise and being unemotionally engaged.
Yep. I did that. That's what the chart celebrates all the giants I met, with poise. you know, there's also an element of second-sightedness in McLuhan. He knew who to go to instinctively, and then he knew what to take, and he knew he'd come up with something. Don Thiel told me that when he met Marshall in 1950, in those 50 to 53 period, McLuhan was always, he said, talking about, I'm going to get power. I'm going to do something. And he was always looking. He says, what if I should write editorials for this newspaper and this and that? He talked quite openly to Thiel about his ambitions. And he had the confidence. He says, I know I'm going to do something. I'm just going to find out where it is. Where can I launch this? Because I'm not hanging around this university environment. These are puny people. You know what I mean?
Right. Joel, absolutely. He was already talking about that in the mid-1940s. There's a letter, it's probably to Ott, Ong, but it may, and it may be to, other Jesuits as well, like McNasby or somebody.
Yeah.
But he says in one of the letters to a Jesuit or to Jesuits at that time that Catholic religion gives people a certain insight into events, which if it's used properly, can obtain great influence. And I think one of the ways that McLuhan was searching around with his flashlight in the 1950s to figure out his way was how am I going to realize the power of something that I have but don't know how to direct.
Yeah, now you say he had another revolution in perception in the late 50s around tactility. Is that what you say?
Well, he does start to talk about tactility a lot in that time period. But I think the revolution that he came to was in deciding that the medium, the definition of the medium, which is to say the medium is the message, is sort of the critical factor for the world right now. You were talking about he was trying to figure out how he was going to have power or how he was going to have influence. He wasn't looking for a great deal of money or a great deal of respect or fame or something like that. He was looking to influence the world in a similar way to what he thought Lewis should have had, but Lewis was ignored.
Right.
So he comes to the idea in 1959, I think it is. No, 1958. In Vancouver is where he first says the medium is the message. And what the light bulb that's gone off in his head is that if we're going to illuminate the interior landscape, it has to take place in a way similar to how the exterior landscape got illuminated. And that is to say, you need to start off with the common recognition of some categories. In the physical world, that was the chemical elements, which people, they began to understand the structure of that around 1800, and then throughout the 19th century, they progressed until they got to Mendeleev's table, where the entire structure of the chemical elements is set out. So McLuhan realized in 1959 that if we were going to get a handle on human perception, we would have to have a similar common focus as that provided in the study of the physical world by the chemical elements.
Yep.
So that's trying to, that's the why the specification of the medium becomes so important. And then 5 years later, when he reads Kohler's Gestalt Psychology, then he realizes that, okay, here we go. This is what I've always been saying in terms of the eye and the ear, but the new way to say that is that in all perception, there's a figure and ground, and the figure and ground have a defined spectrum over which they can vary, and that defined spectrum is the equivalent of the first intuitions of the chemical element in 1800.
Right. Is that, you're saying 5 years later, 1963, 64, he reads Kohler?
Yes. Okay. Just after he finished Understanding Media. Understanding Media was published in the spring of 64.
Yeah.
And almost immediately after that, in I think it was June, he reads Kohler, and he immediately writes several people, and some of which, some of the letters are in the published letters, and he says, I've been really reading Kohler, and now I have to recast everything in these terms.
Mm. Is there a sentence, either in the Manitoba articles he wrote or in his diary, that's the closest to what he's going to discover in the 50s? Have you found?
Yes, I think so. Absolutely. There's a letter that he writes to his family in, I think it's December, could be November, but it's either November or December in 1934. And so this is the very first term he's at Cambridge. And I believe this letter is one indication among several that Marchand is wrong, that the University of Manitoba was unable to provide a decent education to McLuhan.
Mm.
So in the fall of 1934, he already has a very good idea about T.S. Eliot. And he writes to his family. He says that in he recognizes the genius of T.S. Eliot as he's able to provide the background to ordinary life, but without removing that background from ordinary life. In other words, Eliot supplies both ordinary life and what's going on in that ordinary life without separating them, right? So if you think of chemistry, you have whatever materials are in front of you, and that is chemistry, but it's not as if chemistry is some sort of ideal form or some thought pattern or something like that abstracted from the material stuff. The material stuff is the chemistry. And so McLuhan recognizes in 1934 that what's going on in an Eliot poem, and by this time Eliot hadn't even begun the four quartets.
Right.
So he's talking about the pre-four quartets Eliot. He's saying that Eliot presents the surface, but also what's going on in the surface without remove. And so you can see that he's setting up a model where you could imagine somebody presenting the surface, but nothing else. And that's more or less what McLuhan says of Dos Passos. That Dos Passos has a very good idea of the surface, but he doesn't know what's going on in the surface. There's no remove. There's no complication to it.
Yeah.
Somebody else might say, okay, here's the surface of life, and then there are these ideal forms. And it's unclear sort of what the relationship is between these and how you get from the one to the other and all this sort of stuff. So those are two extremes, right? You could call them a platonic extreme or an idealistic extreme and a materialistic extreme.
He says the form point in that 34 letter?
I don't know that he says that, but he's pretty clear that there are these three different ways of approaching the world.
Mm.
And remember, he had studied, he had studied with Lodge at Manitoba, and that was sort of Lodge's whole point, was that there's three different ways of looking at experience, idealism, realism, and pragmatism. And I take McLuhan in his letter to be giving a kind of Lodgian take on literary analysis.
Mm.
So bringing together Manitoba and Cambridge, you could say. But that whole idea that there's something going on in the surface of things that is explanatory of them, but is not separate from them, that idea is what he really explores throughout the 1950s.
Right, and Lodgian is Rupert Lodge?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, just for the people who don't know. And he writes to, I think, Michael Hornianski in 76 that his Menippean satire is a satire on the surface manners or the surfaces of life.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you're getting at, because he also had the science of forms that was underneath that. The surface is satirical, but it's a complex satire because there's some serious remove or science or detachment underneath the satire.
Correct, but the reason the medium is the message is that the detachment that's required there is not obvious, right? The triumph of science, you could say, is getting the correct remove. It can't be too close and it can't be too far away. And so the medium is the message also in that sense.
Yeah. Very good. Now, look.
Here's another.
Look how much you've been talking.
Yeah. Okay, good.
Case closed.
let me give you another quotation.
Okay.
Where the hell is this one from? Cripes. This, I can't even remember where this is from. I'll have to do a search.
I mean, you have it, but you didn't write down the source.
Correct. Like an idiot. And that what that means is that I have written down the source, but in another place.
Yeah, yeah.
So I would never just sort of...
yeah, you never forget to name the source.
Right. Oh, for sure not. For sure not. But what I did was I lifted it out of a post that must be in progress, and I put it into a note for talking to you, and I didn't note where the hell I got it. But it, as we're talking, I'll find it. Anyway, here's the quotation, which I think is apropos. The mere recognition of the existence of the subliminal, and by the way, subliminal, as used by McLuhan, is not subliminal as people talk about it in advertising or something like that. What McLuhan means by the subliminal is what the word says. You know, it's what is below the horizon of awareness.
Yeah.
Right, it's subliminal means below the horizon, so or below the boundary. So the mere recognition of the existence of the subliminal in ordinary human experience seems of itself to create fear and insecurity.
Wow.
End of sentence.
Now listen
since
to this.
Every...
Remember he says in the early 70s that the Japanese... Some Japanese guy gave him the insight about why people won't study media. And the Japanese guy says it threatens their identity. And that's a big discovery, but here he's saying it, you know, 20 years before maybe.
Oh, definitely. Oftentimes, McLuhan would sort of dash off a letter or even a short text saying that something was a discovery or a breakthrough, and really it was a recapitulation of something that he had long thought.
Yes.
No question about it. But let me just give the second sentence, right? So the first sentence is, the mere recognition of the existence of the subliminal in ordinary human experience seems of itself to create fear and insecurity. Since every moment of perception is loaded with subliminal intake, all of us are unaware of most of the factors that shape our experience. So,
what was that? You had a word in the middle there I didn't get. Do it again, this sentence.
Since every moment of perception is loaded with subliminal intake, all of us are unaware of most of the factors that shape our experience.
Right. Now, he says somewhere about the terrors and desires at the roots of language or something. Remember that phrase? Late 40s, early 50s.
No, but it rings a vague bell. It's excuse me. It certainly relates to what we're talking about here.
Yeah.
Excuse me.
Very good finds there.
But look at how that relates to 1934.
Yeah.
Right. This is the quote I read is certainly from 20 or 30 years after, and yet, in a certain way, it's talking about the same thing.
Yes.
Right. He says every moment of perception is loaded with subliminal intake. All of us, since every moment of perception is loaded with subliminal intake, all of us are unaware of most of the factors that shape our experience. So there he was in 1934 talking about how Eliot supplies both the surface level and the level of which we're unaware and does it sort of simultaneously.
Yes.
Does it in the lines of his poetry, he manages to have both of those things together. So I would say from 1934 until at least 1960 and conceivably right until 1980, that's exactly what he's trying to think through.
Right. Now, when he's 19, he says something in his diaries about the laws of media or something. What do you make of that sentence in relation to 34? You know what I mean?
Yes, I do. And it seems to me that...
Did I say media? I meant the laws of advertising, I think it is.
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, that's better. I think it indicates that McLuhan always was aware, even as a child, I believe, that there was more going on in the world around him than most people saw. Right?
Yeah.
So his father would ask him, you know, would you be willing to stand up in a meeting with grown-ups and say the same thing? And McLuhan would say, well, why not? Because it's simply what's going on. Right? And his father would say, well, that's not what most people think is going on. Right? And he would say, it's obvious, isn't it?
What would his father say to that?
He'd probably say, not to everybody, sonny boy.
Yeah, yeah. His geniality of his father, he thought too much, he considered too much the average person's perceptions. He brought him in. So they limited his X-ray laser beam that McLuhan had. McLuhan being more, quote, antisocial or not trying to be congenial. You know what
Correct.
I mean?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And he got that from his mother, right? His
yes.
mother was able to get up on stage and not to be bothered by being on the stage. In fact, to very much enjoy it, number one. But number two, she was a person who was very impatient with her environment.
Yeah.
So she moved away from the family. And once she moved away from the family, she was constantly going to new positions. So she lived in Toronto, then she lived in Detroit, then she lived in Cleveland, then she lived in New Jersey, and she was all over the damn place.
And very restless.
McLuhan, yeah, very. And McLuhan kind of combined the father and the mother.
Yeah.
He wasn't so restless as his mother, but he wasn't as settled as the father.
Say it again, he wasn't as restless as his mother, and he wasn't as settled. That's right, he was right in the middle.
Right. Yeah.
What do you know about his brother, Morris? Have you looked into that much?
Not much. I met him. He wasn't a very deep person. He struck me as a typical United Church minister.
Yeah.
Somebody who hadn't really thought through what he was giving out as absolute truth.
Yeah.
All right. So my whole impression of Canadian and American society in those years, I'm talking at the end of the 60s, was that people were in the business of fooling themselves.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what I thought Maurice was up to.
Yeah, so you could see the subliminals of Canadians.
Yeah, well, one part, because my insight was not productive, right? It didn't get me anywhere to see that. I just raised questions, right? If I can see the insincere approaches of people who think they're talking about the most important things, like religion in Maurice's case, how do you get to a life that is sincerely dealing, is consciously and sincerely dealing with the most important things.
Right. I think he got divorced, and then he started working with McLuhan 69-70 at the coach house. That's when I met him. And I think there's where he had to get deeper. McLuhan forced it. Because he told me, Edgar Friedenberg told me in mid-70s that he was on a panel. Remember I told you? And Morris said, introduced himself saying that Marsh McLuhan was an only child. Remember me telling you that?
Yeah.
Which is pretty brave for a person to do that, but I think that's the mutation he was getting from McLuhan, the transformation. And then when I saw him again in 75, I asked, why did he quit? He quit around 71. George Thompson took over. And he said, well, you just can't be under the shade of a giant oak tree, you know, all the time. So that was an interesting statement. You know, McLuhan was the oak tree. So he gets to be teaching at Sheridan, I think it is. And then you have that great videotape by somebody out in Saskatchewan, Barry somebody, or Richard somebody, who has McLuhan in Morris's class in the first week of 75. And that's a really valuable tape, but you hear Morris, you know, in the background prompting McLuhan or just watching McLuhan's massage. So I think he became a deeper person.
Maybe, but he was always aware of playing second fiddle.
Yeah.
From the time he was very, very young. Right. McLuhan always took a sort of condescending view to Maurice, saying, well, you know, that's very interesting what you're saying, but have you read Maritain? Have you read Alfred Adler? And how the hell can you go to some sort of seminary for ministers if you don't know this and don't know this and don't know that? And then the mother would write, and she would say, "Go easy on Maurice. What do you?
Yeah,
you know, that's treat him, you know, like somebody that perhaps needs some guidance, but with gloves."
And I think, if I recall, in the letters in the 30s back home from England, he was protecting Morris with slight, underestimating of Morris, or accurate estimating. There was the sense that Morris needs to be protected, or I don't know if he's going to be able to take this, but he should do it. You know, there is that. Do you remember in some of those letters?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
So then Morris did Who Was or Who Is Marsh McLuhan. Do you remember the title? Is it Who Was? Maybe it was Who Was. I never can remember. Anyways, you have that book that he did with Barry Nevitt.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I saw him at Barry's house when they were working on it, late 80s, I guess. And he knew enough to hang out with Barry, which was good. Barry was the best student of McLuhan around at the time. And so he respected Barry, so I give him kudos for knowing who to spend time with, and then to respect Barry's commentary under each page or each person's anecdotes. He let that go in there. He might not have been able to do it, but he has Barry leading the interpretation of Marshall's life, you know, throughout that book.
Yeah. Now, I think Maurice was able to get along with anybody, right? That went along with his profession.
Yeah.
He was a United Church minister in Winnipeg and Ottawa, and I think in a couple small towns as well. And, you know, you need to be able to get along with old ladies and young ladies, middle-aged men, and, you know, everybody. And that's, you're sort of, you're trying to be glue to a certain kind of society.
Right. Now, he did quit, right?
That. That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. He from personal and social reasons, probably came to feel that it wasn't a sincere life.
I often thought that Marshall had his brother in mind when he would talk about people in the 60s having an identity crisis. He knew his brother was.
Yeah. But, of course, he knew the same thing from all sorts of students and from his own kids.
Yeah.
So
they lost their mittens, he says, in November 74 to June Calwood.
Yeah.
Okay, so
it was a little bit confusing to him in the sense that he had gone through similar stuff, but he had kind of enjoyed it.
Yeah.
He took those kinds of crises as indicating where he should go as doorways. And so when people, instead of regarding these crises as doorways, regarded them as barriers, he couldn't understand the lack of courage or the lack of humor or the lack of detective sense that would get them to stop at that point instead of going right through.
Right, he, at the very end there's an interview that Nelson Thal got from somebody. It's like the spring of 79, he's out in Las Vegas or California, and some guy at the conference is interviewing him, and McLuhan talks about how he was not interested in happiness. He, as a Christian, was into suffering, and suffering was way more valuable than happiness, and it's probably quite a startling statement for most people to hear someone say, I'm not into happiness, so that's not important.
Right.
You know.
Well, he says something like that to Nina Sutton as well.
In
the tapes with her. He says that he's never been interested in happiness as a goal.
Right.
Right. Of course, there's a big difference between somebody saying, I'm not interested in happiness as a goal, and somebody saying, I'm not happy.
Yeah.
Like somebody can easily be very happy, but not think that that's, you know, a praiseworthy goal of life or something.
Right. And what do you remember what Nina's response was when he said that? Was she shocked?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. Mm-hmm. I would have to go back and look again, but I think she doesn't find that surprising coming from him.
Right.
Right. Maybe coming from most people would be surprising.
Yeah. Have you seen the YouTube of her?
I've seen a video of her in various places. I don't know if I've seen the particular one you're talking about.
Yeah, it's you know, years later, and it's only a minute and a half long or something, and she's just commenting to somebody about something. It's very short.
Yeah, it's a it's part of a website about Brighton. Which is where Nina's uncle used to live.
Right, right.
She's asked for her memories of the place, and she talks, as you say, for about 90 seconds about
yeah.
it, and that's it.
Yeah.
It's too bad that it's not longer.
Yeah. Okay, so what are we doing here now? We're talking about the Esperanto.
Well, that's right. Well, we're talking about the end of the tiny note chart and how we're going to go further. Let me just say in parentheses here that the quotation I gave about the mere recognition of the existence of the subliminal, that comes from a presentation that is on the Internet at the moment in the NAEB files. And it's a presentation that McLuhan made to what was called the Research Committee for his Project 69, and that was the date of it is September 1959. Mm. So McLuhan is well aware in September 1959 that the medium is the message, and what the medium means is the subliminal factors that shape experience, but not as some kind of airy-fairy thing. It's got to be a structure that can be defined in the same way as a chemical element can be defined. The medium has to be something that is open to collective investigation. And it's that idea of collective investigation of what goes on in the classroom, being the same kind of thing that goes on outside the classroom. This is a classroom without walls. That depends upon a common focus, and the common focus is the medium, and the medium is what allows people to investigate in common what the subliminal factors of perception are.
There's that article around 57, Subliminal Projection on Project. You remember that?
That's right. Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
So it's an odd way he goes.
That's in the Canadian Forum, I think.
Yes. So he says subliminal projection on project. So is he saying, here's my ground on my project?
Right. So one of the complications of talking about subliminal factors in perception is that it's bullshit to do that as if only other people had subliminal factors. So one of the tricks that is involved in media study as opposed to, say, chemistry is that a chemist does not need to account for the chemical activity of his or her own brain. There is chemistry going on in there, but it's not integral to, in most cases, what the chemist is doing. But that's not the case with media analysis. You cannot simply say that other people have subliminal factors and not take account of the subliminal factors in your perception of those subliminal factors. So there's a kind of hall of mirrors factor in media analysis that is different from chemistry, but it's one of the signposts that a media analyst has to be aware of in pointing the way forward. This is one more complication that is actually helpful, not a hindrance.
Mm. Yeah, he says at June Callwood that he can't project to people and people can't project to him. Is that a different meaning from subliminal projection on project or on project?
Give me the what he said to June Caldwell again.
He said, she quotes him, he says, people find it hard to project to me, and I find it hard to project to people. Now, he may not have said find it hard. He might have just said, people can't project to me, and I can't project to them.
Uh-huh. I don't know exactly what he meant, but to me it sounds like when he says communication when it happens is a miracle,
yeah,
right? Or
yeah,
communication
of the
mostly
new
doesn't happen at all.
Right.
So I think he's using projection in that sense there.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay, so have we finished the Esperanto? Is the Esperanto,
yeah,
a visual form? Is photography in movies?
Yeah, well, it's. I think he seems to use Esperanto to mean a form of communication that does not require some sort of particular background. Right. So, in the Tribal Encyclopedia of Homer, if you're not Greek, if you're not an 800 BC Greek, if you're not a Greek aware of the barbarians, and on, then you're not going to get it, right?
Yeah.
At all. And so what happens with modern means of communication is that that kind of rootedness is gone beyond. And it's what the alphabet is sort of the premonition of.
Yes.
The alphabet is going to be something you can apply to anything, and it doesn't matter who you are, it doesn't matter about anything. If you know how the alphabet works, it works.
Yeah. It subsumes the local.
Right. Right. So if we try to tie this to the end of the tiny note chart, one question would be, did you write the stuff at the very bottom at the time, or is that a later addition?
No, that's at the time. And it's complementary to the statement at the top, the cyclotron of homeopathic cliche probes causes merging with effects.
Right. Okay, so that I can see that from the other charts, so
yes,
I don't have a problem with that.
Yes.
But, this waiting for organic bodies, I guess this has to do with your wife's research at the time.
Yep.
There would be some sort of new conceptualization of what an organic body means.
When I was on the radio in the 80s on CKLN, I talked about inspiring the Church of the Subgenius. And they, in their what they called divivals, a satire on fundamentalist revivals, they had a band called Doctors for Bob. And it was B-O-B. But in 1990, Nelson, I, and Carolyn thought it would be interesting to put a sign in front of Carolyn's clinic on St. Clair Avenue West near Bathurst that said Doctors for Bob, and it was B.O.B. Okay, capitalized. And it was a bit of a joke. So the traffic was bad there. So every morning people would go to work, and they'd be stalled around her clinic. So they'd all be looking at this sign. Millions of people would have watched it for a year or so, 90 to 91, because she stopped and got ready to go to New York in the last week of December 91. So this was Doctors for Bob. So the last week of her practice in December 91, the colleagues raided her office and grabbed 30 files, you know, haphazardly, and left with them. And said, we'll be getting back to you. It's almost like they tried to nail her before she left Canada. And but the old guy who led them came back in, and he said, what does Doctors for Bob stand for? Is that Bob Ray? It's almost like, are you a communist or a socialist? Because he was the premier for the NDP, the New Democratic right. Party. And Carol says, no, Bob stands for Building Organic Bodies. That was her cover story. So it was brilliant. So that's what I'm thinking of 5 years later when I say waiting for organic bodies. It was based on Bob and the sign that we made.
Why waiting?
Because the sixth level, the Hexhead, is Carolyn's work in 95 in New York City in the lab. And all this stuff is up, goes to before that. It actually goes up to 2020 in the formula chart. But within this one, it's 1960-1990. And it doesn't cover the 5 years from 90 to 95 where Carolyn's stuff would ideally come out and become an environment. So the world is waiting for organic bodies. They're waiting for Carolyn's technology.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm announcing it.
Okay. And then how does that relate to spinning clothing crystals?
Okay. Crystals was a term that William Irwin Thompson used and Baudrillard used. And spinning is the Laroussians would talk about the spinning of matter. And clothing was media as clothing, McLuhan's metaphor for use. So I've got Thompson, Croker, Thompson, McLuhan, and Baudrillard and LaRouche in there. So it's a juxtaposition of the people in the charts. And McLuhan said that all we can do today, I think this is in Take Today, is dance on the other guy's toes because we're all, you know, inside the global membrane in the resonant node. So that's the dancing. LaRouche is dancing on McLuhan's toes, who's dancing on Thompson, who's dancing on Croker, who's dancing on Dobbs, who's dancing on whoever I left out, the fifth one.
Mm-hmm.
So it's crammed with significant, with historical, philological significance.
Mm-hmm.
It has
I looked up. Sorry, I just wanted to say that I tried to find even the word toes in the stuff I have from McLuhan. I couldn't find anything interesting at all about dancing or being on or anything like that. If you find where that quotation is from, please send it.
Yeah, I'm going to have to look for that. So, yes, you couldn't. You have Take Today in your index or whatever you call
yes.
the collection?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, but there's Take Today is a little bit incomplete. There's about 20 pages that are missing for some reason. So it's possible that it's in Take Today, but outside of what I have.
Are those in one section or scattered throughout the book, the 20 pages?
It's mostly in one section, but it's a little bit broken in the 200s.
Okay, let me know that if you know the numbers. So I'll look there first in the missing section. Well, you can look in the missing section, but maybe since you don't know it, you're not going to find it. I might find it. But I wonder, you know... did you ever see the magazine Modern Office Procedures where he serialized Take Today?
No, but I've seen the ad for it.
Right.
I haven't, and I have that ad, I think, in digital form.
Right. So I went and found the magazine, you know, back in the day in the 70s and Xeroxed it. But it's interesting, little essays that probably have different things that are not in Take Today. That might be where Dancing on the Toes is.
Yeah, could be.
Yeah.
That would be that too would be interesting if it's a kind of addition.
Yeah. Let's see. So it's also the spinning clothing crystals is pointing out that this is a biased presentation. It's a flat visual paper page. So I'm pointing at if I had the means to show it, it'd be a quite elaborate video of the each quadrant spinning around the other quadrants. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Is that what you call vertismus, or I don't know how you pronounce the word at the end? Is that English or French, or what is that?
Which word?
The vertisement in brackets at the end of the bottom comment.
Well, that's Hexad, and then it's an advertisement, the whole chart.
Yeah.
So
yeah. It looks like it's a real French word, isn't it?
No, it's meant to be hex advertisement. Maybe I shouldn't have put the brackets around it, but I wanted to have it be both advertisement and hex ad.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's a hex advertisement. Hex advertisement. I can't say it, but anyway, it's a great English word combined.
Yeah, and maybe there is a French word, vertes. I'll have to look that up.
Yeah, it's a French form for sure.
Yeah. So, what else to say about this? The middle column is tensions between environments, like in the larger Dobbs formula chart, and the arrows indicate the tensions. And then I don't know if you want to do it now, but what do you think? Okay, LaRouche. So LaRouche is on the far right column. He seems to be a visual kinetic, and I'm thinking of the American bias on page 136 of Cliché Archetype. Is the American plenary awareness or the American form or the American trait. But he's got visual, so visual kinetic, but he actually is a proprioceptive osmic acoustic guy. He's an oral man, which Americans are on the ground, at least to the degree they're massaged by the 20th century. So that's the ratios of LaRouche's makeup. And then McLuhan is visual acoustic kinetic osmic, and then proprioceptive tactile is ground. You might want to look at that, see if there's any questions or disagreements you have. Now, note with Croker, he's visual acoustic osmic kinetic proprioceptive, not tactile, but he's visual acoustic kinetic. His ground includes tactility. And that's squared because it's the Android meme simulation of the global hologram. Mm-hmm. See, so you're starting to get into virtual reality or whatever you call the weird world after Reagan, say.
Right.
So that.
Why don't you talk a bit about the Android meme? Because even though we've talked about it a little bit in the past. It's still not something that I understand very well, but I know that it's a very important kind of bridge from where we are with a tiny note chart to your book.
Yeah, yeah, to the bridge to the tech body. So I look at the sleeve of Take Today, the book sleeve, and on the back there's a lot of interesting little statements. What stood out to me, though, was how he would use the word software in quotes sometimes, and other times not in quotes. So software in quotes is memes, are memes. So real simply, the world's becoming a communication of memes in the 90s, say. I don't know about the 80s. And it's a automatic process. The machines is past extending our faculties and the Earth, which is extended by the satellite. Now we're into this interactive process where the machines are extending themselves, and it acquires, you know, a kind of AI, which early version is memes. So they're Android memes. It's not an automatic process that humans aren't making. So I want to indicate the robotic or computer world that's beyond human grasp, unless you're a technocrat or something. So that's the Android. And the environments were ideas and patterns. McLuhan's third Copernican revolution, the world of patterns and pattern recognition. And that's all that people were engaged in. That was the present. That was the present environment. And nobody had time to fix the roads or go back to the bridges and rebuild. Because, you know, in the 80s and 90s, America fell apart on the hardware level. It was crazy. Why wasn't anybody going out there fixing and paving the highways? The people were too involved in the processing of the news or of patterns, which always maybe were on the verge of threatening people. And so these patterns became memes. And at the same time as virtual reality is becoming a word in coinage and simulation a little less, but I now claim that my word won because the kids talk about memes. That's their language. They don't say virtual realities or simulations. They say memes. And that's what they process in their social media. So I called it right. I didn't know I'd be right, but that's what it is. So it's...
So am I,
go ahead.
Can we say then that the Android meme is the condition of human-like memes taking on a life of their own?
Yeah.
Is that what Android meme is?
Yes.
Android is an adjective to meme?
Yep. And McLuhan says somewhere in the Schwartz recordings in the late 60s, he says, in the future, just being in touch, knowing what's going on, is all the work required to be a functioning citizen.
Yeah.
And so I call that the processing of memes. And these are software in quotes, or maybe software without the quotes, but they are the what he says by 1974, the cognitive thrill of pattern recognition has become the collective addiction. He doesn't say that part, but he called it the cognitive thrills of pattern recognition, and then maybe he says something after that that implies addiction. So when I found doing this essay, I went back and found verbal modules, that phrase, in Cliched Archetype. And I decided there's McLuhan predicting memes. But he had his own term, verbal module. Mm-hmm. And he talks about Joyce and Eliot using that. So that's how I connect the hardware-software dialectic and the normal McLuhan words in the 60s, 70s. To leap to Android meme is through the verbal modules, which shrink and become holeopathic verbal modules or holeopathic cliche probes. And the phrase cliche probe is in cliched archetype. So this part of that book is not used, you know. It's unused, these points. So I thought it was pretty...
So,
go ahead.
It sounds to me like the Android meme, by definition... does not have any particular animus, right? That it's the Android meme sounds like it might be some sort of superhuman looming figure or something. But if I understand what you're saying here properly, the Android meme is by definition plural and is a condition of memes taking on a life of their own, and in that plurality, they can never be said to have a certain intention. One of them could have an might have an implied intention, but there would always be others that would either cancel that or ignore that or something. But at any rate, in this kind of what we might call a weather of memes,
yes,
there's a complex pattern going on that is probably something that has always gone on in a certain way, but not without ever being understood, and that is particularly noticeable once these things are amplified by the electronic media. And in that amplification, they not only become more obvious, they also become more alive.
Exactly. And, you know, it's an extension of language, which McLuhan says in his PhD, there's a school of thought that language is organic and alive. And so you go back, you go from there up to the electric, organic technology, and then they become, it's part of the shrinking and miniaturization of the hologram that we're in. The effects of the hologram becomes flashing images, flashing news stories. So at the time, 90, 91, 92, in Croker's book, Spasm, Possessed Individual, maybe, Data Trash 94, I had read them, and he talked about the Android processor, Android flesh, and maybe those two terms. And to me, the Android processor were newsreaders, the Barbara Frums, you know, the Walter Cronkites. And, you know, and that proliferates when you get CNN. So he didn't have the word meme, I don't think. So I said, there's something more than flesh. Processing is important, but not Android flesh. It's Android meme. So that's my development from Croker. And then I end my essay on McLuhan, McLuhan and Holopathic Quadriphenia, done 3 years later, 3 or 4 years later, late 90s, as a statement of my talk at the McLuhan Symposium in March 98 that Lance Strait started at Fordham. I end with a quote from the second last quote, I think it's like the 104th quote, is from the 1954 Counterblast, where McLuhan says, "Bless the locomotives whistling on the prairies, proclaiming the separateness of man." So I thought that was pretty interesting. I have a whole history with the word separateness from my cosmic awareness interest channeled in Seattle. So separateness is maybe the citadel of awareness that is not accessible to media. I wonder if I have that quote in here. Accessible. You remember that in Counterblast 69?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Yeah. There it is. Page 135. "And no matter how many walls have fallen, the citadel of individual consciousness has not fallen, nor is it likely to fall, for it is not accessible to the mass media." That's a really important statement that, you know, the student of McLuhan one day has to get to that and be shocked. What do you mean? We're just reading hundreds of words about how mass media alter us, our faculties and everything. What is this? What is this individual consciousness that doesn't get massaged? Or, and that's, you could say that's his Catholicism or something. But that shows you that media interact with media, not necessarily the human form, other than surface clothing styles or something. But it's very interesting, don't you think, that statement?
Absolutely. The I guess prompted by you, I wrote a whole post on this called The Very Citadel of civilized awareness.
Oh, I got to read
I do
that.
Is I go through all of the different mentions of the citadel in McLuhan's thought.
Good. I want to read that.
Here, I'll give you a quote from Joyce, Portrait of an Artist. The very frequency and violence of temptations show him at last the truth of what he had heard about the trials of the saints. Frequent and violent temptations were a proof that the citadel of the soul had not fallen.
Ah, very good. And where's that? In Portrait?
Portrait, yeah.
Wow, I missed that one. So there it is. As McLuhan would say, Joyce got there first. Okay, so then I end with this quote from Spasm, subtitled, this is Croker, Virtual Reality, Android Music, and Electric Flesh, page 53, 1993. So he says, a culture of quantum fluctuations where you can only know that you have never seen what you thought you were looking at because you have never really heard what you were listening to. That's the world of the Android processor and the Android meme. These patterns are turned over so fast that most people are living in a state of unconsciousness once you get into the speed up of the late 80s or into the 90s. You see what I'm saying?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
But I would say to in my nonlinear view, I would say what's going on there is that something that has always gone on is illuminated by the speed of communications.
Right.
Right? That there was nothing new at the surface level. There was something new at the potential level of awareness.
Yes. The big now, the layers of the onion are being unpeeled, and Ion said the tech body was back there lurking beside the Ark of the Covenant. And when the Hebrews gave their power to the Ark of the Covenant and didn't keep their own power, that's being replayed by the way people are giving over their power to the tech body and this stupid world of the Black Mirror we live in. With everybody just looking at their cell phones constantly.
Mm-hmm.
That's losing their power to the tech body. So,
right. So just back up from there. Go backwards from tech body. Haven't you drawn a pathway between the tech body and the anthropomorphic physical in the past?
Well, anthropomorphic physical is the Dobbs quadrant on the tiny node chart, so it is in relationship to the Android meme, and that's something like the private citadel or citadel of consciousness, the anthropomorphic physical.
Oh, okay. So it's the opposite of the
Android meme.
Tech body.
Yes, it's not embedded in the media or in anything. That's what humans do. They project themselves in nature or in technology. So the extensions of man is an anthropomorphic statement. The media
right.
aren't necessarily extensions of us.
Okay, that's interesting. So I had previously understood you to be saying in the mid-90s that the extensions of man had left man and had taken on sort of a life of their own. But here you seem to be saying that no matter what the extensions of humans, there's still the citadel that remains in place.
That's a possibility I include, but I'm not sure that's true.
Okay.
Yeah, that's where.
So it's a quest. It remains a question.
Yes. Yeah. That's right.
Uh-huh.
I'm known to be an incredible questioner. Ian has complimented me on that. So, yes, my chart's a question, and So I do the anthropomorphic physical quadrant. So is it clear what I'm saying about what the Android meme is? You got it now?
Well, I don't know. I mean, you would be the judge of that.
Well, okay, we'll have a test next week.
What I said was the Android meme is necessarily plural, so it's not something that can be singularized and said to have a point of view or a point of animus or something like that. It's the contest, like a cloud chamber, of memes.
Yeah.
And that this, in our times, this becomes a kind of addition to the physical universe as the motor of things.
Yes. I think of what he says in Ecclesia Archetypes, that Paradise Lost is about how Milton confused, Beelzebub, or whatever term he uses, confuses his mind with language. And I'm saying, wow, the complexity of language becoming, through the evolution of technologies, through the Android meme, no wonder everybody's a basket case and can't handle where we're at today, because we've been squared by technology leaving us and extending itself, and then we perceive it as this quantum fluctuations of patterns that we hardly notice. And, you know, there's this joke in cartoons. I think Jules Pfeiffer talked about it in his Village Voice cartoons back in the 80s or 90s, that people did not have consciousness anymore. They were pinheads. Yeah, that's the phrase. My consciousness is basically a pinhead compared to what's swirling around us.
Yeah.
And
yeah, Robert Crumb do, or I don't know if it was Robert Crumb, but wasn't there a comic strip about pinheads?
Yeah, that's right. You know, some weird ghostly shape guy. He was a pinhead.
Yeah.
Yeah, some odd shaped thing. Yeah, what was that? I don't know if that was Crumb. I've seen it. Yeah, so there we were, pinheads. And so McLuhan has that quote from the 60s where he says, the areas where we exercise our private conscious or conscience, I don't know what he's saying there, our private conscious, are so puny compared to what we should be exercising concern about. Remember right. that statement?
Sure. And that's basically what he'd been saying since about age 5.
Yeah. Yeah, the subliminals. So we have come around full. Whatever we were saying at the beginning of tonight, it was a good question to ask me to define Android meme, because it brought up stuff that we had said throughout the night. It circled back.
Right.
So now the tech body is this world of quantum fluctuations of patterns, which are almost indifferent to humans, becomes, quote, a psychopath and really starts to try to bug humans. So it's a further coming alive process, and it turns aggressive on humans. And so it elected Trump. It elected Biden. It's causing the crazy world. The memes go up and down every day, and nobody even knows what. Have you heard that many people the last 6 months or a year have said, this is weird. The news doesn't make sense anymore. Have you heard of that popular sentiment now being commented on?
Sure.
Yeah. I mean, more than whatever anybody said before. Oh, and when people talked about in the 60s about the media, that was the phrase. People would say, the media is doing this. They had a sense that the media was something out there, independent of humans, doing stuff to us. The real term for that would be Android meme. But the idea that something was happening beyond human control, expressed by the word media, is what I'm trying to express with the Android meme. And they just had an old-fashioned word on it. That's the horror. Was it the horseless carriage? When you call the Android meme, which was the ground from 60 to 90, you use the old term media. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, but here you seem to be singularizing Android meme.
I would say it includes a singular. It's a crystal. Now, Baudrillard writes about this. His terms, you can apply it. I'm sure he had an influence on me. He talks about the object or the crystal that's attacking us. So he sees the simulation becoming sometimes or half the process. It is an object. And that was expressed in The Exorcist, McLuhan said. People were possessed by the electric media. So, and then Croker has the book, The Possessed Individual. So something, quote, an object is possessing us, but is what it's made up of is endless turnover of imagery, which would be some kind of infinite sphere or bouncing, ricocheting mirrors is the constituents of the Android meme. But there more and more seems to be an intelligence behind it, which would be the reason in the Internet era that everybody thought, and it became the most popular content, that there was a conspiracy happening. That was a projection on the Android meme on the tendency to make it a singularization. So then you get those four statements we talked about last week. Is it, says McLuhan, collective phobia, national myth-making, cultural norm functioning, and individual sensation? And those terms are used in my explanation of the chart called Up the Orphic Ante. So I'm exploring what it is on different levels. You can't say it's one thing or another.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So if you ask me, is it not, it's not singular, right? I'd agree. But then I wait for you to sort of notice, oh, well, you seem to indicate just there that it's singular. And then you say, well, didn't you say it's, you just said it's singular. I say, yeah, including that. But you have to tell me, you have to say it before I acknowledge it, so to speak.
All right.
I did a talk in Halifax in 1984, and at the end, the audience person said something like, well, you've left out the whole world of advertising and manipulation and, you know, content, MKUltra programming of people. And I said, yes, and I was quoting McLuhan, what he said to the guy who ran Ramparts in the 60s, when McLuhan died, this guy, I forget his name, wrote a little obituary on McLuhan out there in San Francisco. And he quoted McLuhan saying something, yes, that's what I meant when I didn't say it. So that's what I said to this guy. I did include that, but I didn't have time to say it.
Yep, yeah, the unsaid.
Yes, the unsaid, I'm including the other half. And then McLuhan says that. He emphasized the medium and left out the users of content, and it wasn't until Charles Reich, the Greening of America, 1970 or so, wrote to him and said something, and McLuhan said, yes, the user is the content. I think maybe even Reich said that, and McLuhan says, yeah, that's good. That's the best statement I ever said about the medium as a message ever. I think that's in Take Today he talks about that. And so there is... He consciously, as a satirist, I guess, left out the other half. And, people in the 60s kept saying, well, you can't go on about the media. What about the content? And McLuhan would be oblique about it. And then he admitted it in the 70s. Yes, I left that part out.
Well, he said from very early on, he took over from Eliot, that poetry, and by extension, any human communication can communicate beyond itself.
Before it's understood.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Absolutely.
So there he was.
That was
consciously making poetry with that principle.
Yeah.
So very clever what he did. So.
Yeah. So I'm kind of running out of steam.
Yeah, you got to go.
Yes, but. What I would recommend for one of our talks is the whole question of is McLuhan in some way exceptional to these other people like Croker and LaRouche?
Yes, that's a
Thompson.
Good, very important.
Absolutely, because I think we have different views on it, and different views are exactly what you need for dialogue.
Yes. No, that's something I think about a lot. What would I say to that question? So I got a lot to say about that. So I'm going to write that down so we'll remember. That's the question what we start with next week. And But this was a perfect way to wrap up the chart, is to explain what the heck the Android meme is, which I feel
absolutely.
I've done.
Absolutely, yeah. And I've already sent you the post on the Citadel of Civilized Awareness.
Right, and
so you can look that up.
We got to look that up, right. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, thanks a lot, Cameron. Another great talk.
Okay, Bob. Yeah, look forward to the next time.
All right, bye. Talk to you soon.
Bye-bye.
Bye.